From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Butch Cassidy, famous for train robberies and bank heists, epitomizes the lawlessness and recklessness of the Wild West. But he was no roughneck. Butch was known as a gentleman, affable and hardworking, and in his partner Sundance's words, the brainiest member of the bunch. Bill Bettinson grew up hearing tales of his notorious great-uncle Butch, stories which prompted him to collect letters, talk to old-timers, and even travel to Argentina to separate the truth of Butch from fiction. Today on the program, Bill Bettinson joins us to talk about what he's learned about the legendary Butch Cassidy. Plus, a mashup of puppets, science fiction, and show tunes. Aliens, the puppet musical. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Bill Bettinson grew up hearing stories about his infamous great-uncle, Butch Cassidy. As a kid, he sold T-shirts in his family's tiny museum dedicated to the outlaw. As an adult, he gathered stories and records and traced Butch's journeys from Robber's Roost to Argentina, and now he's decided it's time to publish what he's learned. Today on the program, Bettinson joins us to talk about the memories and legends in his new book, Butch Cassidy, My Uncle, and Bill Bettinson joins me in studio. Bill, good morning.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here.
He is the great-grandnephew of Butch Cassidy, again, author of the book Butch Cassidy, My Uncle, A Family Portrait. He will have a Q&A session and a reading, a book signing for his book tomorrow night, May 24th, at Ken Sanders Rare Books here in Salt Lake City. We'll give you details on that as we go. Later on in the program, we turn to a very creative interpretation of the classic sci-fi film Aliens. But first, to Butch Cassidy. If you have questions about the notorious bank and train robber, you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Bill Bettinson, I would venture to say that most people are familiar with Butch Cassidy from the film Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Butch famously portrayed by Paul Newman. What do you think of Newman's portrayal?
I like the movie a lot. I think it's a fun movie, and if anything, I think it got people interested in history and finding out more about Butch. Lula, my great-grandma, actually, when they found
Butch's sister.
Butch's sister, yeah. When they found out she was still alive, they invited her to the set. And I think she liked the movie. She saw it a number of times. You know, she didn't like the ending of it, but she thought that the portrayal of by Newman was good, you know, that he captured his character in that. So she was pretty pleased.
No doubt, Butch Cassidy has been an enduring piece of family history for you. As a child, was there one particular story about Butch that really captured your imagination?
Well, I've just always been interested in the Old West and cowboys and that. And probably the thing that really sparked it all for me, you know, was when the movie came out. I was just 4 years old, and they wanted Grandma Lula to endorse the film, and she said, well, I'm not going to do that until I see the film. And so she had a little family premiere. I believe it was in the old Blue Mouse Theater here in Salt Lake that was long gone. Mm-hmm. But anyway, my parents couldn't find a babysitter, so I got to go. And I just remember sitting there watching the movie just thinking, you know, this is the coolest thing in the world. And this is my, you know, my uncle that I've heard stories about, you know. So it just kind of got me excited about it from that point on.
Now, you are a mechanical engineer by training, and you've worked in the oil and gas industry for a couple of decades, but you have been on the side collecting stories and documents, sort of digging into this past of Butch Cassidy for years. Why did you decide it was finally time to document all of this?
Well, yeah, it kind of evolved over time. You know, I started out just, you know, being interested and wanting to, you know, because there's so much myth and folklore associated with Butch. I wanted to try and nail down as much fact about his life. And the book kind of, the idea of the book kind of evolved over time. And it's like, you know, at some point I need to put this down in a book, at least for the family to have and, you know, for others too. So
mm-hmm. Your great aunt Lula, who you mentioned, she also wrote a book about her brother. What did you think was missing in her account?
Well, part of the problem there is she was very close to the embarrassment of having an outlaw brother. So I think there's some things she hesitated to talk about. And enough times passed, you know, the generations have passed that embarrassment isn't there anymore. You know, it's more of a fun family history, so we can talk about those things now. And I think that's what I tried to capture. I mean, I talk about, and this isn't well known, but he had another brother, a younger brother, that was an outlaw, and I tell his story. And she didn't want to talk about that because he had a family, and she didn't want to bring shame to the family. Mm. So, but I've since, and friends with him, talked with him, you know, their cousins, they want to know more about their grandpa, you know, so that embarrassment part is gone now.
We're speaking with Bill Bettinson. He is the great-grandnephew of Butch Cassidy and author of the new book, Butch Cassidy, My Uncle, A Family Portrait. There will be a Q&A session and a book signing for the book tomorrow night, May 24th at 7 o'clock at Ken Sanders Rare Books here in Salt Lake City. If you have questions about Butch Cassidy, feel free to give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Well, tell us a bit about Butch Cassidy the person. We know he was born Robert Leroy Parker, grew up in Circleville, Utah.
Yeah, that's right. He was actually born in Beaver. When he was 13, the family moved over to Circleville, and then he left home at 18 to strike it out on his own. And that's the thing is, I think one of the reasons why he stands out in history among other outlaws and bandits was he had a lot of good in him. You know, people were drawn to him. He was very charismatic. You know, he liked people and that. He wasn't the, you know, sociopath. He wasn't a killer. And it's fun now to travel around, especially as I go up into Wyoming and that, where he spent a lot of time. There's a lot of people that have personal family stories or ties to him through their grandpa or grandma. And, you know, he's, in their mind, a good guy. He wasn't a bad guy, so.
He was born to good pioneer stock, Mormon family. You note that he was especially close to his mother. And I guess that's his turning against the law really caused her a lot of pain in later years.
Yeah, most definitely. Lula always said that he had broken his mother's heart, you know, that he had, you know, decided to follow that path as an outlaw. But I think that upbringing with a, you know, a family, a warm family and whatnot, I think that helped, you know, make him more of a, you know, I don't know, just a complete, you know, not the sociopath type person, but just a, you know, have some goodness in him too, and that, you know, he was drawn to these people and wanting to help other people and stuff. I think that, you know, that upbringing and that helped with that.
Mm-hmm. Very good natured, had the reputation of reaching out to others. You write of an encounter he had with a young boy, and he bought him a white horse. And so he was generous in that way, and yet he was attracted to the dark side. You note in the book that he met his first bad influence while he was working on a ranch in his teenage years. What do we know about the outlaw Mike Cassidy?
We really don't know a whole lot about him. There's different stories in that, but we don't really know. I mean, there's ideas that maybe he ended up down in Fort Worth. There was a Mike Cassidy that they found on the census that owned a saloon down there. But and then there's other stories of Mike Cassidy helping the Pancho Villa and that. But I think they're just more folklore than anything, and so we don't really know a whole lot other than this was somebody that Butch looked up to and that gave him his first gun and taught him how to rustle cattle and whatnot. And, I think he had fun with that. You know, he was kind of drawn to having some money and stuff because he came from a large family that was really poor. So I think that excitement of having a little bit of money and just the adrenaline rush of kind of breaking the law and stuff was kind of attractive to him.
Mm-hmm. He took the Cassidy name as an alias. Where does Butch come from? There are a number of theories out there.
Right. Probably the most, or what I tend to agree with, was Lula said that he had worked in a butcher shop up in Rock Springs, Wyoming. And as I tried to nail that down, it's like every butcher shop in Rock Springs claims that he worked there. So it's kind of funny how everybody was embarrassed by him, but now everybody wants to be included with him. But I don't know that he spent a lot of time in a butcher shop. I think maybe he supplied stolen beef to the butchers and whatnot, you know, and then that nickname just came from that association. There's another story that Matt Warner, another outlaw, tells about him shooting a gun that threw him back on his hind end, and the gun was called Butch, and that he, you know, picked up that nickname from that. But I think it's probably more related to the butcher shop or supplying stolen beef.
Mm-hmm. I believe his first bank robbery was in Telluride, Colorado.
Correct.
This is June 1889. And you write that this really was a turning point for Butch. Expand on that, if you would.
Well, yeah, up until then he was, you know, associated with some rustling of cattle and whatnot. When he made that decision to rob a bank, I mean, he became a real outlaw then, you know. And it's interesting because a pattern that he kind of developed throughout his life was trying to, after a robbery, he would try to blend in with the community. He'd go to work for a ranch, area ranch, and just kind of blend in. And he was able to do that to some degree in Wyoming after Telluride. And this is a whole other story about him being arrested for horse theft in Wyoming and actually spent time at the territorial prison there in Laramie.
A couple of years.
Yeah, actually 18 months. He got out for good behavior. But they never associated the Telluride bank robbery with when he was incarcerated in Wyoming, which had happened, you know, a few years before that. So. Mm-hmm.
So he was a chameleon of sorts.
Right.
And you note that he was very willing to work.
Right. Yeah, he had a good work ethic, and ranchers liked him. There's a number of different accounts where when he was working on a ranch down in New Mexico, they wanted to make him the foreman of the ranch because he was a natural leader and had command of his men and that. And I think, you know, if he would have chose a different path, he probably could have been successful in other areas too. But I think he was always looking to put that outlaw past behind him and become a rancher and a successful person that way. And I think that's why he went to South America to try and start over.
Mm-hmm. Speaking with the author Bill Bettinson, he is also the great grandnephew of Butch Cassidy. He's written a new book about a lifetime of research, Butch Cassidy, My Uncle, A Family Portrait. He will be reading from and signing the book tomorrow night, May 24th at 7 o'clock at Ken Sanders Rare Books, 268 South 2nd East here in Salt Lake City. If you'd like to join us, if you have questions or comments about Butch Cassidy, about the legend, about the fact and the fiction, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking about Butch Cassidy and separating out the fact from the fiction. Bill Bettinson is a great-grandnephew of Butch. He has spent a lifetime collecting stories, digging through archives, and visiting the places where Butch spent time, sort of piecing together details of Cassidy's infamous life. He's written a book about what he's learned, and he'll be reading from this volume, Butch Cassidy, My Uncle, A Family Portrait, on Thursday, that's tomorrow night, May 24th at 7 o'clock at Ken Sanders Rare Books here in Salt Lake City. And you can join the conversation if you like. Butch grew up in Utah. He spent a lot of time in the state. Does Butch figure into your family stories? What do you want to know about the irresistible Butch Cassidy? You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Bill Bettinson, he did spend spent a lot of time in Utah. He grew up here. He had a number of hideouts in the state, including one called Robber's Roost on the Lower Green River. Describe this place for us.
Well, it's still very remote, and it's a favorite spot for hikers and whatnot. And they, I guess the they're still getting lost out there, you know, as they go out. But it was probably the attraction was that lawmen didn't want to go in there because there were only very limited sources of water, and it was able to, you know, because of the narrow canyons and whatnot, you're able to defend it fairly easily. So I think it was a good hideout for the outlaws.
Mm. You write that it was here that Butch planned out a train heist, the Castle Gate payroll robbery. What happened there?
Yeah, actually that was a gold payroll robbery. But yeah, they spent the winter before they robbed the payroll in Castle Gate in April of 1897. So they spent the winter before that planning it and, you know, training their horses. And they actually brought a couple of wives or girlfriends in to spend the winter with them. And I've heard from some friends that have located that winter camp that it's still very remote, and there's, you know, old tin cans and whatnot from the camp that it's pretty much been preserved all these hundreds of years later.
You know that there was a newspaper account of the robbery, and they wrote that the robbery was accomplished with so much bravado and daring.
Right. Well, because it was, a daylight robbery and it was payday, a lot of men were, over 100 men were there waiting to get paid. Many were holding guns, weapons, and whatnot. So it was very daring, and so it had to be planned out to the, you know, just exactly so there wasn't a hitch in it. And there was a couple of scary moments, I'm sure, for Butch, because his horse actually started to get away from him when he had got the payroll and was about to take off, and his partner was able to corral the horse so he could. But I'm sure that his heart was pumping there, knowing that he could get left behind without his horse with all these men and their weapons. So,
sure. Speaking with Bill Bettinson, the author of the book Butch Cassidy, My Uncle, A Family Portrait, and 801-355-TALK is our number if you'd like to join us. This email from Shane in Kaysville, he writes, "My family and I are rafting down Desolation Canyon this summer. Could your guest speak to Butch's time hiding out in a ranch in Desolation Canyon?"
Yeah, absolutely. He had a good friend that supplied horses actually for Castlegate, Jim McPherson, and he had a ranch that's still there in Desolation Canyon, Florence Creek Ranch. His descendants actually own the Tavaputs Ranch, which is up on the top of the book cliffs there overlooking Desolation Canyon. But I believe you can stop, and there's several old, I haven't had the privilege of going and seeing it myself. I'd like to do that at some point, but a lot of the old ranch buildings are still there. You can stop and look at them, so.
Well, Shane, that's something to look forward to. Thanks very much for the email. 801-355-TALK is our number. Speaking with Bill Bettinson, author of the book Butch Cassidy, My Uncle. When did Butch Cassidy hook up with Sundance?
Well, I don't know that we know exactly, but we kind of tend to think it was later on. It wasn't early in his career, and it was mainly out of necessity, because his best friend really was Elsie Lay. And Elsie Lay, when they were, Butch and him went to New Mexico to work on the WS Ranch, Elsie decided to join up with the Ketchum gang, and he was captured, wounded and captured, and so he went to prison. And so he wasn't available to go to South America. So
he needed a partner.
He needed a partner, and Sundance filled that role for him. And so it was probably the late 1890s that they became friends, and you know, 1901 is when they actually headed to South America. So,
were they friends? I mean, would you say they were friends, or were they partners?
I would say they are friends. I don't know that Sundance was really his best friend. You know, maybe at times because of. But yeah, I think he was a trusted friend. I mean, yeah, you'd have to be in order to, you know, do the things that they did. So
the two of them, they had a number of encounters with the law. They eventually fled to Texas, and that's where the most famous photograph of Butch Cassidy was taken, with the so-called Fort Worth Five.
Correct.
What can you tell us about why they decided to sit down, get spiffied up, shined up, clean, and take a photo?
Yeah, I don't know that we know exactly why, other than it was probably a big mistake, because then the Pinkertons had positive identification of each of the bandits.
And the Pinkertons, of course, were the detective agency of the time.
Right, and they were really the ones that were chasing them. And they had just robbed Winnemucca Bank in Nevada. And Butch was probably involved in planning a train robbery in Wyoming. So they went and met in Fort Worth. I mean, Texas was a place where they went in the wintertime to kind of get away from the Wyoming cold and whatnot, and visit the brothels and whatnot. But there was, at the time, Will Carver, another outlaw in the gang, was getting married, and so there's a possibility that maybe they had decided to, with their new duds, to have that picture taken as part of a, getting together for his wedding. But the story is that the photographer was very proud of the picture, and so he displayed it in the window, and authorities were able to identify probably Will Carver in the photograph. And then from there, they contacted the Pinkertons and then made wanted posters, and then
15,000 flyers, you say?
Right. Yeah. So they really, got the word out on him.
So eventually, this photo brought some notoriety. Butch, Sundance, and Sundance's girlfriend or wife, I'm not sure which, at a place.
Right, yeah.
They eventually fled to New York City, spent a little time there.
Correct, yeah, and that's where the Pinkertons' headquarters was. The Pinkertons didn't find out that they had been vacationing in New York until they were in South America, and they were quite upset over that, but... Yeah, at a place, Sundance introduced her to his family as his wife. I don't know that they were ever married. They may just have been common law. I don't know for sure. But Butch actually posed as at a place's brother as the three of them traveled to South America.
So they boarded a ship to Argentina. This was in 1901. Do we have any sense of what their plan was? Why did they eventually decide it was time to leave their life of crime behind them and to create a new life in South America?
Yeah. Well, Butch had tried a number of different avenues to try and, start over. He'd even met with an attorney here in Salt Lake to see about getting amnesty and putting his outlaw past, in the past, so that he could start over.
And Governor Wells was, at the time, just about ready to agree to that.
Right. Yeah, there was an account where he was going to meet with Governor Wells. None of that was able to be worked out, and so I think he just decided to literally go to the other side of the world and start over, Argentina, Patagonia area was kind of the land of opportunity for a lot of Americans were going down there because land was cheap and opportunities were there, and so I think he had every intention to start over, to be a rancher, and to put his outlaw past in the past. And I think he would have if Pinkertons had never caught up with him. I think he would have, because he was well liked. He was, he was friends with the governor. The governor for the area, when he came through, stayed at their ranch.
The territorial governor in Argentina, as well as the police chief,
right,
stayed overnight at the ranch. That's great.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You can't make that up.
Yeah. He certainly went out of his way to make important friends, because I think that would have, obviously it paid off for him. But That kind of was a pattern, too, throughout his life, too, was he had a number of influential friends. And if you look at when he was pardoned early for good behavior from the Wyoming pen, there was a number of people that signed a petition. There was lawyers, judges, sheriffs, all these prominent individuals in the community that signed this petition for him to get out. So he was certainly well-liked on the other side of the law, too.
Bill Bentenson, author of the book Butch Cassidy, My Uncle, A Family Portrait. He's the great-grandnephew of Butch Cassidy, and he'll be reading and signing his books tomorrow night, May 24th at 7 o'clock at Ken Sanders Rare Books here in Salt Lake City. If you'd like to join us, if you have questions or comments about Butch Cassidy, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So he finds a nice quiet place in the middle of nowhere, Patagonia. He creates a ranch. He's got his powerful friends. And then there's a train heist. Butch and Sundance were fingered in that heist, even though it doesn't appear that they had any involvement in that heist, but it certainly made them settle their accounts, and because they were associated with the robbery.
Right.
You know, it is kind of, I guess you read the book and you are a little sympathetic toward him. you want him to be able to have that good, straight life.
Right.
At some point. Why do you think that's just impossible?
Well, you know, it's hard to put certain deeds in the past, you know. I mean, it's, you got to kind of pay the Reaper at some point, I guess, you know. I don't know. That was something that he battled with throughout his life. His brother, he was captured and spent time in prison, and he got out, and he wanted nothing to do with being an outlaw after that.
He was given a life sentence,
right,
for like $40 or something. It was just a paltry amount, but it was a mandatory sentence.
Right. Yeah, you never want to mess with the U.S. mail, and that's what they used force and got into the mail, and so it was a life sentence, and it took a presidential pardon that the family worked with the senators here from Utah for a number of years to try and get the presidential pardon. Grover Cleveland first denied it, but William McKinley finally granted it at Christmas time. And that's a pretty touching story. Annie, Butch, and Dan's...
Annie, his mother, of course.
Is his mother, and she wrote a touching letter to William McKinley thanking him for the pardon of his son, of her son. So,
You write that your great... Aunt Lula,
great grandma
Lula. She tells of Butch returning home for a final visit in 1925. What do we know about that reunion?
Well, you know, that's the big debate with Butch Cassidy that probably will be debated to the end of time, is what happened to him. Was he killed in Bolivia, or did he come back to the U.S.? She maintained that he did come back to the U.S., that he came back to Circleville in 1925 and spent time with the family and stayed in touch until he died in the 30s. And the book really, you know, I get into all the different theories and talk about the possibility of him being killed in Bolivia. And then I also give the family account. And I still support and believe what she told, that he did come back. And there's also a number of reliable eyewitness accounts of other folks that saw him back in the U.S. after the gun battle in 1908. So
you think that he did come back?
I do, yes.
I mean, is it just Lula's story that puts that question to rest for you? Or
that's the strongest case for me, but... you know, her son was there and saw him, and that's a person I knew well. I mean, I knew Lula well, and they weren't people to lie to their families or lie about something like that. I don't know that they had anything to gain by it. So, and for a lot of years, they didn't talk about it. It was something that was only talked about in the family. So, yeah, those are probably the strongest cases for me. But there's others like Josie Bassett, the Bassett family from Browns Park. Butch had spent time with them. He visited, she's claimed, two different times with Elsie Lay in the 30s. And Elsie Lay's grandson, who's a good friend of mine, interviewed Josie and, really pressed her on that. And she maintained that that, in fact, had happened. So,
well, we'll go with that. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Let's go to the phones. Don is with us from Salt Lake City. Don, welcome. Don, are you there?
I'm here.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, I, by the way, I was born in Beaver also. a minor coincidence. But anyway, I had a missionary companion who told me this story about the ranchers up in Dingle, Idaho. They were being hit by some rustlers that were rustling their cattle. And one evening, the rustlers were in their camp, and this group of men rode in on their horses, shooting their guns in the air, and it happened to be Butch Cassidy. And he said to the wrestler, he says, "Now you leave the Mormon ranchers alone."
Well, that's a great story, Don. Bill Bettinson, does that ring a bell of the kind of character, the values, if you will, that Butch Cassidy had?
I think so. I think it. I haven't heard that specific story before, but that certainly. There's other accounts of him making sure that no one was hurt. I mean, when they are involved in robberies, I think part of the planning, the months of planning that were involved, was he didn't want to see people hurt. You know, he didn't want to see people killed, and I think he tended to use his head, use his brain before using his gun.
Hmm. Don, thanks very much for the call. You know, even though Butch Cassidy was he was a bank robber. he got what he wanted. He broke the law. I get the sense from reading your book that you really like this man.
Yeah, I've spent a little bit of time. I'm probably a little too obsessive about it. But yeah, I mean, 20 plus years studying his life. So yeah, I think he had some good in him. But you know, it's interesting because Lula always reminded us that he was a bandit, that he was an outlaw. He had broken the law. He had broken his mother's heart. She didn't want any of the grandkids idolizing him and following his path, you know. So she always made that clear.
You've been tracing Butch Cassidy's journeys, you know, piecing together this life for many years now. What do you think is left to uncover? You know, what are those unanswered questions that you still have?
Well, for me, it continues on. I mean, I'm still very interested in it. And I don't know that we're finding anything earth-shattering, but we're finding little parts and pieces to the puzzle, you know. And that's always exciting to add something to the picture, you know, that nails it down, that it's an actual fact. And, I mean, I enjoy that. I mean, I spent some time down in Arizona just a month or so ago following up a lead. So I still it's still a game and it's still fun, and I'll just continue on with it. So
what kind of reaction have you gotten from your family? I mean, for many years this was an embarrassment. Nobody wanted to talk about this, you know, this non-law-abiding part of your family history.
Right.
Now has enough time passed where people are embracing Butch Cassidy as a family member?
Yeah, I think so. There was a few that didn't want me to talk about certain things, and because they were probably a little bit closer to that. But you know, most of those folks have passed away, and most just want to know more about their family history. So there's been a lot of support within the family.
Bill Bettinson, he is the author of the new book, Butch Cassidy, My Uncle, A Family Portrait. He's the great-grandnephew of Butch Cassidy, and he'll be reading from and signing his book tomorrow night, May 24th at 7 o'clock at Ken Sanders Rare Books, 268 South 2nd East here in Salt Lake City. And Bill Bettinson, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, sci-fi puppets and catchy tunes. It's Aliens, the Puppet Musical. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Think back to that classic sci-fi film Aliens, you know, the mid-80s movie where the heroine Ellen Ripley faces murderous extraterrestrial creatures. Now, add show tunes and puppets, and you've got the latest offering from Meat and Potato Theater. Today on the program, we get a behind-the-scenes look at Aliens, the puppet musical. And joining me in studio is Tobin Atkinson. He's a playwright, writer, director, actor. He's appeared in numerous productions at Plan B Theater, Salt Lake Acting Company. He's currently the artistic director at Meat and Potato Theater, and he's written many full-length plays and adaptations, including the latest, Aliens, the puppet musical. Tobin is in studio. Tobin, welcome. Thanks so much.
Good morning.
Also with us, joining us by phone, is Josh Temke. He is the lead puppeteer in Aliens, the puppet musical. And Josh, welcome to you. Thanks so much for your time.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
If you've got questions or comments about Aliens, the puppet musical, I've got 1,000. Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Meat and Potato Theater presents Aliens, the puppet musical. This Friday, it premieres May 25th, and it runs through Sunday, June 10th at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center here in Salt Lake City. We'll give you more details on that as we go. Again, you can join us, 801-355-TALK. Tobin Atkinson, I guess the question is why? Why combine puppets, throw in a few show tunes, and retell the story of aliens? It's a great combination.
This actually comes out of a disappointment that we had. We started the company in D.C. In 2005, and we were slated to do a show called Die Hard, the puppet musical. That show premiered in 2008, I believe, late 2007, at the New York New Musical Festival. It had gotten a lot of buzz. We got a hold of the script and the music, and it was right up our alley, because our goal is to tell compelling stories in the most powerful way possible. And I think with Die Hard, the puppet musical, we were on to something. We got the rights for it, and then there was a change of location. We actually moved to Salt Lake. We had the opportunity to take some careers here. And in that process, we lost the rights to that. And it was about 90 seconds later that we had decided, well, if we can't do that, let's step up to that plate and swing as hard as we can. And that's how we landed on Aliens, the puppet
musical. Aliens, of course, a great second choice. For those in the audience unfamiliar with Aliens, could you just sketch out the very basic plot points for us?
Sure, sure. This is the sequel to Alien, the first movie by Ridley Scott. And that movie's more of a horror genre. And then 57 years later, Ripley, after she has killed the first alien, she is rescued and discovers that she's been asleep that long, and that she's now called back to the planet where the first alien was found. And this planet has been transformed. It's no longer this rock floating in space. It's actually got people living on it. And the colony there has gone silent. And so she's asked to join these Marines that are going to go back and rescue these people. And of course, it's just one disaster after another.
Now, you have references, characters, phrases from Star Wars, from Star Trek, yeah. 2001 Space Odyssey, The Matrix, The Twilight Zone. I mean, it goes on and on. Do you have to be a sci-fi geek to get the jokes in this play?
No, we're following the story. We keep the story there. The reason we put these other references in is because this is the way that we're billing it, is a mashup tribute to all things sci-fi, puppet, and Broadway musical. And no, we weren't high when we actually came up with this. This was something that we really, really wanted to do. And because we love all of those things, Marianelle Hinton and I that run the company, we grew up loving all of those things. And I think both of us grew up in a theater community that really opened us up to experiencing those things on stage. We didn't go to a lot of theater where people just talked each other to death. We went to theater where, Fred Adams ruined me down at the Utah Shakespeare Festival, where I went to see plays when I was 14 years old, where the King and the Queen of the Fairies had huge fights right there on stage and turned people into donkeys, or there were battle scenes right there on stage. And I think there's this trend in modern theater to not do that. Of course, we're going to get half a year of Les Mis in the state, but and all of those elements are there in Les Mis. But this if you like that kind of theater where you go on an adventure, where it's not just sitting and watching people talk about a subject, this is something you're going to want to come see. So the references are really there just to heighten the experience. But the story is there. You go to three different places, three different worlds. You go to Galactica spaceport, and then you're on your way on the Sulaco to this distant planet. And then once you get onto the planet, it's a whole new world there, too.
We're speaking with Tobin Atkinson. He is the writer, the director, the force behind the latest production from Meat and Potato Theater, Aliens, the puppet musical, which opens this Friday. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Also joining us by phone is Josh Temke. He is the lead puppeteer in the production. I guess we need to turn to puppets, Josh. Being a convincing actor is one thing, but being a convincing actor and a puppet master at the same time is quite another thing. How difficult was it for the actors to learn how to be puppeteers as well?
It is a challenge because, you know, you're so used as an actor, you use your whole instrument, your body, your voice, you're being seen by the audience. But with the puppets, you know, we're out there with them, but we're covered head to toe in black. You can't see any bit of us. So everything has to go through that puppet. So you yourself, you want to be at a still place. You don't want to upstage your puppet. But at the same time, you've got to bring that puppet to life, and all those emotions have to come through that puppet, and all that truth under imaginary circumstances has to come through that puppet. So it is definitely a challenge making that happen.
Hmm. You play a number of characters around, I understand, but your primary role is Bernie. It may sound familiar because it's based on Ernie from Sesame Street.
Yes, he bears an uncanny resemblance.
How did you channel Ernie for this role?
I grew up watching Sesame Street and the Muppets and loved them, and I still do. So, I just tried to put on my best Bernie-sounding voice. But at the same time, you know, it's also based on the Bill Paxton character in the Aliens film. So it's sort of a combination of those two characters. It's not strictly being Ernie from Sesame Street. I'm also a space marine. I'm also reacting to all the crazy stuff that's happening to us on this dangerous adventure. So it's kind of a combination of those two.
Give us your Bernie voice, if you would.
Well, for example, I meet up with an old friend in the play who has an uncanny resemblance to Bert. That his name is Burke. So when I discover it's him, I say, Oh, hey, Burke. Hey, how's that bottle cap collection coming? And so on and so forth.
That's great. That's Josh Temke. He is the lead puppeteer in the upcoming production, Aliens, the Puppet Musical. Also with us, Tobin Atkinson, who is the artistic director of Meat and Potato Theater and the writer-director of this production. Let's get to the musical part of this. I want to play part of one of the songs from the play. This is the opening song that you hear, My Daughter's Eyes. Tobin Atkinson, anything you want to say about this before we take a listen?
Sometimes the gods just smile, and we found this a gentleman named Rob Hartman through another friend that I've known for years. I said, listen, we can't pay you anything, and he goes, this is not about money, this is about being part of something that's right up that I've been waiting for. And so he very graciously took on this project, and I just think he did an amazing, amazing job.
This is My Daughter's Eyes from Aliens, the Puppet Musical.
Way up here among the stars, it's heaven, so people say. But having seen here what I've seen, I know it's not that way. The air is thin, the ships are cold, the loneliness can get real old. Where nightmares live outside your dreams, no one in space can hear you scream. But back on Earth, I have a love as wide as a galaxy. Within a house, down by a lake, an angel waits for me. There's nothing here.
That's from Aliens, the puppet musical. The air is thin, the ships are cold, the loneliness can get real old, but back on Earth I have a love. There's real sweetness to this song. Tobin Atkinson?
Yeah, this is based right on the movie. Comes out of the fact that there's this passing reference that Ripley has a daughter. So when she went out on the first journey 57 years earlier, this girl was 10 years old. And, of course, the girl has lived her life and
she's in her 60s.
Yeah. And so Ripley actually becomes this childless mother. And then, of course, we meet a character later on in the play who is a motherless child. And these two are destined to become come together.
It's
great writing. We couldn't mess it up if we tried. And these references to Burke and Bernie and things like that, they're right out of the script. The character's name is Burke. It's the Paul Reiser character. And if I'm not mistaken, Ernie Hudson is his name. And so it was just easy to make that change. And that's not the, I mean, those are the two obvious ones. We've got Princess Leia, Organa, Private Organa is there, Private Snake Plissken, Lieutenant Flash Gordon. It's filled with characters that people know, and now it's self-referential. So you see Flash Gordon trying to lead these group of Marines. So you're in on both jokes at the same time.
Now, you have some experience with the military. There is a military component, the Space Marines, but in real life, you spent some time in the Army.
Yeah, best mistake I ever made. I joined in 2000. I enlisted in infantry. Spent 4 years, 4 years, 4 months and a day in active service, but I didn't last long in the infantry. I got to the 16th Infantry in Fort Kansas. I did some pretty high-speed stuff, got my expert infantry badge, got my stripes, became a sergeant. But then the Army found out that that actually paid for my master's degree at the University of Utah. That was part of my enlistment deal, which was in theater, directing. And so they said, well, how would you like to come over to Army Entertainment? And so I said, well, don't throw me in that briar patch. And so I spent 2.5 years making plays for soldiers. I went downrange with a local play, the Farley Family Reunion. Mm-hmm. I took that to Iraq and Afghanistan.
Speaking with Tobin Atkinson, he is the artistic director of Meat and Potato Theater, their latest production, Aliens, the puppet musical. Also with us, Josh Temke. He's the lead puppeteer in the production. Josh, what was the attraction of doing Aliens for you? Why did you want to get involved and be part of this production?
Well, you know, this is, what, Tobin, the fourth show we've done, you and I?
Yeah, it is our fourth.
But and you know, we're friends behind the scenes as well, and gosh, it had to be at least a year, maybe more, ago that Tobin and his wife Mary Nell told myself and my wife, who was also in the show, about this idea, Aliens the puppet musical. And you know, my wife and I are sci-fi geeks, so I mean, they had us right there.
We had you from the word done. Yes, Josh's wife, Rebecca, she plays the Ripley character.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason that we love working with Josh is, and I've said this to his face, so this isn't a big surprise for him, he's one of those actors that's so rare that you say, listen, this is, I'm going to cast you in this. In this production, it's 3 or 4 roles. And you say, listen, this is what I need you to play. This is kind of where I think they need to go. And he bobs his head and he says, yeah, okay. And then the next time you see him is at the opening night party, because you never have to talk to him. He just does the work, and he's so good at it that that's why we put him as the lead puppeteer, because he not only nails what he needs to do, but he also inspires others to step up and do the right thing too. Mm.
Well, thank you. I do what I can.
We've only got about 30 seconds left. But, Tobin, what's the goal for this show? Is it belly laughs? Is it comic relief? You know, what do you want audience to get for their ticket price?
Our mission is to tell compelling stories in the most powerful way possible. If you want to come and go on an adventure, we make it akin to getting into a roller coaster ride. That bar comes down when the lights go to... The audience goes to half, and we just hope you make it all the way to the final act.
Tobin Atkinson and Josh Temke with Meat and Potato Theater presenting Aliens, the puppet musical. It opens this Friday, runs through Sunday, May 10th at the Rose Wagner. Gentlemen, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The air is in the ships.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Lauren Hendrickson. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Tomorrow, Why We Write. We'll have the author, Steve Almond, answering your calls.